Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with poet and dream therapist Roger Kamenetz, whose new book is Yonder. Readers love Roger Kamenetz for many reasons. His searching memoirs, such as The Jew and the Lotus, Stalking Elijah, and Terra Infirma, My Mother's Life and Mine. Then there's the groundbreaking approach to dream work in The History of Last Night's Dream. Lovers of poetry can turn to The Lowercase Jew, To Die Next to You, many others, and now a new work called Yonder. That's what we'll be talking about today. Roger's a dream work practitioner as well as a professor emeritus at LSU, where he founded the Jewish Studies program and helped to shape the creative writing program. Roger, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hey, Susan. Thank you so much for having me.
So Yonder is a collection of prose poems pulled from your dreams. Am I right? So where is Yonder? What is the dream space?
Yonder is the space beyond, and it's also what we're all longing for. It's that missing piece that keeps us in desire. It's the desire that feeds on its own hunger.
Mm-hmm. I always think of it as vaguely Western, you know, out yonder. You know what I mean?
Yes. Although I think it's probably Old English, too. It's probably a pretty old word. I like the word because it's not used much as a word.
It has a certain glamour as a word.
Right. It's sort of, it's been under the pile of pennies for a long time, and now it's still shiny.
Bring it out, right. You know, add some sparkle.
Well, I wanted to suggest that a word that's both familiar and odd, mm-hmm. and in ways that's our dream experience too, isn't it?
So what was your experience writing these poems? I mean, they sound somewhat different from other things you've written, but mm-hmm. the sense of humor is so clearly yours to me, and, mm-hmm. you know, that sense of occasional oracular wisdom. You know what I mean? You can sit back and go, here.
Right. Yes, the oracle should get credit, whoever she may be. Basically, because of the work I'm doing with dreams, what I call natural dream work, I've been immersed in people's dreams. I listen to them very carefully, and I've been writing down my own dreams as a practice, really for the last 18 or 20 years, I think. And so having a bad short-term memory, I would leap out of bed in the old days and go to my laptop to write them down. And now I just reach for my iPhone that's charging next to the bed and jot them down with my one finger typing. One night it occurred to me, because I've always been puzzling, what is the connection between dreams and poetry, since I do both? And one night it occurred to me that instead of writing down a dream, I could write a poem. And the poem would be in prose, because I was writing in prose, inside the little Notes app for iPhone. The slowing down, actually, of the writing was important, too, the one-finger typing.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, because you had to kind of pause in between lines. And I saw that the poems would unfold as a series. Dreams move. They pretend to have a narrative, but really secretly they're poems. And they move from feeling to feeling to feeling. In other words, something happens, and then we're responding to that. And then we're responding to the next thing and so forth. So instead of a linear logic, they have a dream logic. So I wasn't interested in writing, recording dreams as poems. I think that never works, or almost mm-hmm. never works. But I was interested in writing from dream mind, or writing, in the perfume of the dream. In other words, in the feeling of having dreamed and moving, staying in that state of mind as I was writing.
Right. Well, you know, Bob Butler talks a lot about that too, writing from where you dream. It's an interesting connection for writers to make, I think.
Right. I think for most people, we have experiences of what Coleridge called primary imagination in dreaming, but we have it in all of our creative activities, and we certainly have it in making poems. But in dreaming, it's very free, and it's very unconstrained and uncensored, and there's room for both the silly and the oracular in the same poem. And I think that that's, mm-hmm. that range is a possibility that dreams encourage.
Well, one of the things I love about these poems is that they have that dreamy energy of odd juxtapositions and wild humor and their own internal logic, you know, once you see it later. So did you go back after you wrote these down as you put the collection together and edit at all?
In the first part of the process, I'm editing continuously, and while I'm in the fluidity of it and constantly changing and sometimes have little slash marks to indicate, oh, maybe this word is better than that word, uh-huh. you know, maybe eels is better than lampreys or something, you know, and then yes, ongoing editing and culling and kind of saying, that wasn't so good. But overall, I think the imagination seeks a kind of unity, mm-hmm. Not necessarily a logic, but a unity. In other words, and what I was listening for often would be to pick up something that happened in the beginning and make sure it kind of happened at the end. The poems definitely have a sense of echoing and of reprising or returning from where they began very often.
Mm-hmm. Do you dream every night?
We all do. We all dream 4 or 5 times a night. That's science.
That's science. Oh,
that's
science dream and poetry.
Science. Right. That's right. There is a science to poetry. But William said poetry is the reality on which science is based. I was like that.
I love that.
That what we're studying at this minute level of chaos and movement is the stuff of poetry, you know, the world making itself.
Well, I have to go back to a history of last night's dream. I mean, every time I read that book, I start to remember my dreams.
Right.
It's hypnotic, Roger.
It's obligatory.
No, it's like give you a little bit of homework right there.
Well, you know, there's been a kind of convergence in my, maybe I'm reaching the last station, but it's a convergence between dreams and poetry. So I've been teaching about the healing images in Wordsworth and mm-hmm. healing images and dreams. So I've been sort of reading a lot of the romantics. And yeah, I think more and more these two they're really two sides of the same experience of imagination.
Are most of the people who work with you writers?
No.
How interesting.
Some of them have become writers.
Ah,
or
Roger.
Painters or healers. And it's just what their own impetus is that the dreams encourage.
Doesn't that make you feel wonderful?
I do feel like I'm part of I'm a midwife of
exactly.
of people breaking their shells. There's a lot of work in the beginning to break through the old habits, the old construction of self, of I, and then the emergence of this more fluid and supported soul. Mm-hmm. That you know, I mean, one of my clients' dreams literally this wonderful woman came and gave her paintbrushes and showed her canvases and. She's now become a painter.
That's pretty clear.
I mean, yeah, that was an easy.
The message is clear.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty clear. But the issue was, could she receive it?
Of course. Of course. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear some of these dreams. I love the judgment of the alligator, particularly because it has that perfection of a fable.
Yes, thank you. The judgment of the alligator. I'll just read it, I guess, right?
I guess.
There's no sense commenting on it. Okay. The judgment of the alligator. The people who hate God say, you are not on our side because you don't hate God. They want to make a zoo of it and pen the people who don't hate God. But an alligator crawled to the edge of the fence and said, I'm here by mistake. While I'm not sure whether there is a God, so I can't really tell you yet if I hate him or her, I can be certain of one thing. If I am quiet long enough in the marsh and my eyes poke up just barely, I can usually snatch a mammal in my teeth. Can I leave the pen of hopeless God-lovers now? A commission of God-haters is convened. Everyone on it judges who is hopeless for God and who can leave the pen. They've never met a case like this. There were great debates. Can an animal be a proper atheist? They gather around the alligator to decide whether he can leave the pen. No one believes an alligator can really talk, but one judge believes this is possibly an alligator simulation. From the looks of his corrugations, he seems to be a good atheist, but no one is sure. After all, weren't animals once called creatures? And doesn't that imply a creator? But maybe, one judge says, that was a misnomer, and they are really just accidents. Doesn't look like an accident, another judge says. She cautiously strokes its tail, but the alligator remains subdued, even in its upper teeth. Then the chief judge of God-hating, extremely tall and confident, stands before the alligator to pronounce judgment. I hereby. But before the sentence ends, the alligator's jaw snaps down on his thigh. He takes the judge in three quick bites. There's thrashing and blood. The alligator tries to apologize, but it is hard to make out his words as he chomps down on the chief judge. Bits of bone fly out of his eager jaws. The other judges run. The alligator swallows and says, You may hate me, but you have to admit, I am a fine machine, and I don't belong among the hopeless lovers of God. As one judge flees, a thought drops in. Perhaps I am a simulation of God. In most other universes, she gets away. But in this one, the alligator grabs her by the knee. Oh, my God, she says. She hears a voice. I am not your God, but I am your alligator.
I love that so much. Sometimes when you have a dream, don't you just sit up and go, thank you. You know what I mean?
Right. I noticed you called these dreams, but it's which I
know,
love.
I know.
I like that. But
but I guess that's how I think of them. I
okay, mean, fine. You know, I know. I wish I could have a dream like that. But it was, yeah. Thank you so much. What can I say?
Oh, but it's so, I mean, it's everything. It's so funny. It's so right. It's, I mean, that will always be one of my favorites of your writings,
good.
I think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Now, some of these are written for family and friends, and there's one that you wrote for your son-in-law.
Right.
The Living Hive. And
right.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that, because he's big into community gardens.
Right. Well, Jordan Bantwell and my daughter, Kezia, have this group now. They call it All You Need Is, A-Y-N-I. And they, you know, Jordan is active in teaching skills like how to raise bees and make mushrooms. And they've also, they're starting a sort of an ecological sanctuary up in Mississippi. But for a while, Jordan was being called by people to remove bees from their homes. Apparently, there's nobody else to do it. And
there aren't many people who do that.
No, and there's good reason.
Yeah.
You get stung. But he seems to have a feel for it. And I don't know, there's something. I've been to their they have a place in Toledano where they have keeping some bees. And there's something mm-hmm. really peaceful about keeping bees.
Yes.
And sort of cooperating with them. So this poem was dedicated to Jordan. And actually, almost all the poems are either directly or indirectly dedicated to people I like or love, including you.
Thank you.
but it made me a sense that, well, at least there's one person who's going to read this.
The poet's hope.
Right. I thought it was a way to increase the audience. So I'll read this from The Living Hive for Jordan Bantwell, keeper of the urban farm. You have seen a bee face up close. The verbs fell away. The sky tore strips of wax paper. You heard the thrill of the bees. You felt the stings. Through the metal hexes of fence, your fingers caught. Sleeping, you hurtled in a Beethoven surge. The geometry of winter, an angle of dead bees. The secret honey in the cells of six. The smell of honey heals all wounds. White wax kisses them, seals. Still, you hurt underneath. The stars really do have sharps. The sky black as bees' eyes. You go on, unforgiven. Hungry for honey. Hungry for balm. Hungry for wings.
Oh, Roger, I was reading that and the stars really do have sharps. Mm-hmm. That was just magical. It was like you'd plucked that out of the sky just for that poem.
Well, this idea that everything, that's the sense of the unification that spreads over all, so that bees lead to Beethoven. Beethoven leads to sharps and flats, mm-hmm. but also pain and stings. So it's all, you're in this place, I call it the imaginarium. You're in this place where everything's floating around and it's all available, echoing. So they almost write themselves.
And very free.
Very free.
Too, you know?
Very free. A lot of the work I do with dreams is to disabuse people of their fixed narratives, because the way we ensure that we have a solid eye is to create a story about that eye, whether it's I am great or I suck. It doesn't matter. As long as I
is right in there.
But when the eye kind of disappears, then there is this freedom and motion that is poetry. You mm-hmm. know, maybe Williams was right. It is the stuff that science is ultimately studying, this sort of free movement.
But will they ever get everything there is to know about it? I think not. There is the mystery. You have to have a bit of mystery.
I think that they give us metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
So I thank them.
That's useful. Very useful.
I love science. I have no issue with it.
And of course, you know, books. So the Illustrated Book of God is one of my favorite poems because I can imagine it perfectly.
Mm.
You know?
I wish I could. You could tell me more.
That's what I get. That's what I get for loving poems. So much of it is not completely verbal.
Okay. I'll take a hug.
Okay.
That's good. So the Illustrated Book of God. I mean, it's interesting the poems you picked. I mean, they say something. You know, I mean, I love it. I that's terrific. So I'll read it. The Illustrated Book of God. I opened the Illustrated Book of God. It was written all of gold letters. There was a fire on page one. The flames licked the page. I stopped reading with my eyes and read with my tongue. I tasted vermilion. I put my ear to the page and heard the lion's roar. I heard the clouds. I touched the bleak thorns of the acacia. I marched on oceans. My feet grew weary. I sank into the delicious black mud with bare feet and bare bottom. I opened the door to the stranger who lit candles in the sun. I walked on the moon. I knew strange love of every kind. Nothing was forbidden. I knew what other men thought they knew. The father came to me and blessed my broken mind. He comforted the mother who had lost her child. He sang of the shepherd and the shape. My body disappeared, and I walked into pages. The gold letters left imprints on my subtle body. I knew and knew the end and the beginning. I tasted the water of loving kindness and drank a fill. The peacocks led me to the horizon. The elephants recited their Bible. The lions returned and ate my heart. I died in the dark of my last page. The book went on, still unopened, still unknown. Its hand beyond knowing.
I love that, Roger. Oh. You and I, you know, we've talked about books as objects so
right.
many times.
Right.
And I think of that wonderful essay you wrote about the burned books of...
Franz Kafka and Nachman, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you know... And I think of the books of Anselm Kiefer, mm-hmm. those terrific artworks,
right.
and just so much richness in that poem.
Mm-hmm.
It just conjures it all up for me. You know what I mean?
Mm. Oh, I understand. Now I understand why you liked it.
So that's why I picked it.
I get it. Okay.
The elephants in their Bibles, and the whole thing. It's just...
Right. Well, there is this way that you can sort of fall into a book and it becomes a world. And,
yes.
And then I think that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was interesting to read it. I hadn't read it out loud, so I actually liked the poem.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you do. I hope you like it as much as I do.
I think I do now.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you've had a really great year in your entire family. I mean, mm-hmm. your daughter Anya's had a book come out this year
right.
about screen time for kids.
Yes. And yes.
Kezia's working with you mm-hmm. in your dream work practice.
Mm-hmm.
And Moira Crone, your wife, did the cover of this beautiful book.
Yes, she did.
So and I wonder if you talk a little bit, describe it for us. It's so lovely.
Well, I want to give credit also to Bill Lavender, who designed the cover and who's the publisher. But
oh, Bill knows how to make beautiful books.
He does.
He really does.
The way in which he took Moira's painting and turned it 90 degrees, and then he sort of set the word yonder up at the top in an italic type, so like it's leaning towards the right.
Yes.
And it feels like it's leaving the top of the book and maybe going floating off on its own. But these forms that Moira made are both, they're sort of physical. I mean, you could see them as a body, or you could see them as sort of big hearts of different shapes and colors floating up in some sort of medium. That's the way I'm looking at them right this moment.
Right now.
And I haven't had anything to drink, so it's good.
And those gorgeous blues, those gorgeous blues.
Oh, I love
the blues.
And you know, Moira's working, as you know, really hard on a wonderful novel. But in between, she's painting up a storm, and I'll brag and say, but she recently sold two paintings, one at the Lemieux Gallery and one at another gallery.
Fantastic.
So she's, her painting career is also taking off. I don't know, we're just having fun.
I know, you're all synthesizing all these things.
Right.
Now, you'll be at Octavia Books with Kezia,
right.
who'll be talking about her journal, The Dreaming Eye.
Right.
So would you like to say a few words about that as well?
Yes, Kezia's, we're both work is in natural dream work, but she has a wonderful way of working with people, and she goes under Kezia Vida on her website and stuff. But this journal is a way to help people who really just want to write down their dreams, and she gives little guidelines and hints and suggestions for ways of thinking about your dream or feeling your dream more deeply. And so this is a really good do-it-yourself kind of approach to working with dreams. And so she'll be presenting that at Octavia, and I'll be reading some poems. So we'll have sort of a dream poetry night.
Nice. Oh, nice. I know on her website, Kezia talks about the terrific responsibility she feels for mm-hmm. working with people
right.
and their dreams. And I know you feel that very keenly as well.
Right. Well, I think that I do. I mean, I think we're dealing with the most precious part of people. And when people share dreams with you, we should listen carefully and be loving with the people, because they're sharing the parts of themselves that maybe usually don't get talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's so naturally warm, and I mean, she's really, really good at this.
Well, do you find that working with your dreams has made you kinder to yourself?
Mm. It's definitely introduced me to different kinds of self, and that helps, because the plurality, the multiplicity of who any one of who I am or who you are helps. Oh, I can find that part that relates to the other person mm-hmm. In me already.
You know,
Whitman has that line, I contain
multitudes. Yes.
But it sounds like a boast when he says it, but I think what he really means is more humble, just I can access a way of understanding you because I've paid so much mind to what's going on inside of me.
Well, Roger Kamenetz, no end in sight. I always feel bad when I see you and I don't have an interesting dream to tell you about.
Oh, well, make something
up. I'll have to work on that.
Okay, Susan.
We've been talking with Roger Kamenetz, whose dreamy new collection of prose poems is called Yonder. You can meet him Wednesday, January 9th at 6 at Octavia Books, where he will be appearing with his daughter, Kezia Vida, who will be presenting her dream journal, The Dreaming Eye. Roger, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Susan.
I followed you to Texas. I followed you to Utah.
We didn't find it there, so we moved on.
I followed you to Alabama. Things look good in Birmingham.
We didn't find it there, so we moved on. I know you're tired of following my lucid dreams and schemes, for they're only fleeting things, my lucid dreams.
I had your child in Memphis.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Brandy Perry discusses and signs her novel Splintered, Sunday, January 6th from 2 to 3:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Charles Brown signs his novel Looking Back on Sodom, Tuesday, January 8th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Roger Kamenetz discusses and signs Yonder, Wednesday, January 9th at 6 at Octavia Books, where he will be appearing with his daughter Kezia Vita, who will be presenting her dream journal, The Dreaming Eye. John Pope discusses funeral customs and obituaries and his book, Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Wednesday, January 9th at 6 at Gallier House, 1132 Royal Street. Tickets available at hggh.org/GallierGathering. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Frick Collection present a two-day symposium January 11th through 12th in conjunction with the Orleans Collection, an exhibit dedicated to the collecting and collection of Philippe II, Duke of Orleans. It's on view at NOMA through January 27th. For the complete symposium schedule and to register, check out noma.org. Roy Schmidt and Rosary Hartel O'Neill sign New Orleans Voodoo, A Cultural History, Sunday, January 13th from 2:30 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. In Covington, writer O'Neill Deneau will talk about the Battle of New Orleans and his novel, Battle Kiss. That's at the English Tea Room in Covington, Friday, January 11th from 7 to 9. Call for reservations at 985-898-3988. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.